WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new satirical novel, Turn of the Century, Kurt Anderson has imagined life in the year 2000 and what he sees as a culture taken over by infotainment, the internet, and corporate advertising. The two main characters are in the thick of it. George McTeer is a TV producer. His wife, Lizzie, is a software entrepreneur who has designed a Y2K program. Turn of the Century is Kurt Anderson's first novel. He's a columnist for The New Yorker, former feature writer and architecture critic for Time magazine, and former editor of New York magazine. He also co-founded and edited Spy magazine. Let's start with a reading from Turn of the Century. George McTeer is in Las Vegas for the opening night of a friend's new entertainment complex called Barbie World. As limos pull up and Ken and Barbie-looking celebrities step out, McTeer walks through the crowd onto the rainbow-colored conveyor into Barbie World.
The interior is a three-level shopping center decorated in Camelot mod. The pinks come in even more varying intensities and textures, along with a lot of silvers and golds. Every Barbie World employee is under 30, and both genders have the look of tarted-up Protestant missionaries or very wide-eyed adult film stars. In the date zone, one of three restaurants, there's a pink telephone on each table from which diners place orders for deep-fried, fat-free cheese sandwiches. The gym offers karaoke aerobic dancing, and life-size as-if portraits, live, giant-screen video images distorted by means of a very convincing digital effect to reduce apparent body mass by up to 20%. The basement equestrian center, which a sign says will feature white ponies exclusively, is still under construction. Barbie Home is a large pseudo-apartment where Barbie ostensibly lives, like Santa in his workshop in Macy's, and where all of the furnishings are for sale. Barbie World has what one of the guides describes as four separate wearables boutiques, or clothing stores, for girls and women. Barbie Baby, Barbie Wear, Maximum Cute, for teenagers, and Madam Barbie, sizes up to 24. Doll clothes for Barbie, and for every friend and hanger-on Barbie has ever had, are available at the Totally Perfect Mall, a warren of 17 separate fashion mini-boutiques packed into an acre of floor space.
That's Kurt Anderson reading from his new novel, Turn of the Century. You know, in reading your book, Turn of the Century, I was wondering how the process that you use to design the world that your characters live in. I mean, a lot of it is just a slightly different version of how we live today. But there's so many new TV shows and products and shopping malls and so on that you've made up for the novel. Did you just keep like a directory of things that you were imagining ought to go in this book?
Not that ought to go in this book, but I had made notes and make notes, as writers do over the years, of notions, some of which were just fantastic notions for some book, some piece sometime, and some of which were half-serious notions of, well, maybe someday I'll pitch that to some television executive. And my intention was to make them, as you say, plausible, but somewhere between actual but not so extreme or satirical or hyperbolic to be entirely implausible. And that's it's an interesting line to walk, or was to me.
Well, I think I can give an example of what you mean. George, your main character, is a producer for MBC. MBC stands for the Mose Broadcasting Corporation, named after Harold Mose, its billionaire owner. And I was reading that thinking, oh, I see the statement Kurt Anderson is trying to make, that someday soon, instead of it being like the National Broadcasting Company or the American Broadcasting Company, TV networks will be named after the billionaire owners. And then I thought, wait a minute, Turner. It's already happened.
No, exactly. And you see, that was a case where the network is entirely invented but exists in my book within the reality of today. It is the fifth network along with Fox and NBC and CBS and so forth. So as much as possible, I tried to make a kind of seamless or virtually seamless adjacencies between reality and the kind of hyper-reality, I guess, of this novel.
What are some of your favorite shows that you've invented for the Mose Broadcasting Network?
I would, well, there's my favorites as interesting shows, and then there's my favorites as sort of ghastly satirical ideas. One of the former, a show that I would actually enjoy seeing, is a sort of combination of Candid Camera and The Twilight Zone, in which instead of simply people being led to public telephones that don't work or work in some comic fashion, sort of practical jokes of a supernatural kind are played on them. Suddenly, everyone in their offices disappears, and some green phantasm appears before them, or essentially giant practical jokes that would be played on people as hidden cameras tape them, that would be intended to really freak them out and make them feel as though life had turned upside down altogether. I think that would make great television. There are some others. One of the shows that NBC shows that I am convinced will exist, perhaps before the paperback of this book comes out, is a kind of morning show with attitude, some crossbreed between the Today Show and Good Morning America and the existing morning television chat shows, and a kind of Howard Stern, shock jock zoo kind of show. That's what they do in the morning. So there's a show called Quacks Like a Duck. I love the title. I don't know what the show is. It was the one show that I just loved the title and left it there without any further explanation.
The world that you've created for your novel, which is set in the year 2000, is a world that's really, in a lot of ways, owned and marketed by celebrities. For instance, Lizzie George's wife eats a meal of Paul Newman popcorn, Michael Jordan cottage cheese, and Cherry Garcia ice cream. And now the only food there that doesn't already exist is the Michael Jordan cottage cheese. At least I don't think it already exists.
I don't think it already exists either. But in fact, it's true that there is that kind of celebrity theming, sort of lurking like a dark mist around the edges of the story here. What I've enjoyed, and I noted it when you said I don't think that exists, in several interviews and several reviews of this book, there have been lists ostensibly of my inventions. In almost every case, there's one thing that really exists in those lists, and that confusion on the part of close, intelligent readers between the real and the invented gives me great pleasure. For instance, I mentioned sort of minty flavored liquid Prozac for children, which one of my reviewers thought was, you know, an amusing, horrible, satirical invention, and unfortunately or fortunately is absolutely a real thing.
Well, you know, you've said that we're living in a time when almost everything, news, politics, advertising, the computer revolution, is a form of entertainment. In one of your New Yorker columns, you described President Clinton as the entertainer-in-chief. What do you think some of the problems are about a culture in which things that shouldn't be entertainment become entertainment? What are some of the manifestations of that?
Well, certainly I think one of the reasons for the survival, if you will, of President Clinton is the fact that as I argued in that piece, that a good, solid, not only plurality, but probably majority of Americans regard politics, national politics in Washington at this point, as primarily entertainment. And so the Monica Lewinsky episode became, a year-long program about low comedy and hijinks in Washington. Because I think Washington right now and national politics right now are as irrelevant to the lives of Americans, most Americans, as they've been in my lifetime and maybe in this century, I think it's understandable that politics becomes interesting only when it becomes entertaining. It's not so much about the kind of endless leeching of entertainment as that is, I think, a result of the absolute unchallenged ascent of marketplace values. Again, in my lifetime and maybe in this century, we have not had a time in this country where the bottom line criteria for the success or failure of anything, a book, a movie, a building, a form of art, a news program, whatever, is judged by how it performs in the marketplace. And so that leads, I think, inevitably to treating everything whether it's news or whatever it is, as a form of entertainment, because entertainments can be rated according to its moment-to-moment popularity. And so I think this transformation of so much of culture and economy into entertainment is really a byproduct of this sort of final end of the 20th century triumph of capitalism.
I think your novel also gets this sense of the sometimes uncomfortable or odd interrelationship of the arts and corporate culture. I mean, for instance, you know, John Williams is writing the music that corporations use when they put you on hold on the telephone. So he has one symphony, the U.S. West Symphony, for when yes. you're on hold with the airline, and another symphony that you've called Fanfare for the New Economy.
Yes. That's a movement of the U.S. West Symphony. It's all okay. part of a grand scheme that he's done. And it's part of this great ascension and hegemony of the marketplace, where that is simply the way it works now. I later in the book have a documentary about the Mexican Civil War that I posit going on in the background, being underwritten by Benetton and MTV. And I think that's the, you know, that is the world in which we live, and I don't know that it's going to go on forever, and I kind of hope it doesn't, but I don't see it ending anytime soon. I think we're at the high point of a cycle of as you say, of the corporate brands intruding into every realm of life, the arts, and so on, and the old categories of what was art and what wasn't, and what was off limits for corporate branding, like half the baseball stadiums in America, and what isn't. Those rules have been, those lines that were pretty bright even 10 years ago, and certainly 20, have been muddied, and that makes I think a fertile ground for writing an entertaining story about everybody's confusion.
My guest is Kurt Anderson, whose new novel is called Turn of the Century. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kurt Anderson. His new novel, Turn of the Century, is a social satire set in the year 2000 that satirizes entertainment and celebrity culture, business culture, corporate culture, lots of
computer
stuff.
Computer culture.
Computer culture, absolutely. Your novel strikes me as being written by someone who is kind of forced to keep up with things and has become both amused and disgusted by it?
I don't know, but certainly I'm amused and disgusted. Forced to keep up, I wouldn't quite say. I mean, I think it's very hard to not be, somewhat disgusted by much of what's going on. And I think simultaneously it's very hard or uninteresting to me to be not entertained and occasionally inspired. I mean, there is potential for good and liberation in the digital revolution and even in parts of the kind of triumph of the free market. There are good sides of that, and that's what I was trying to depict. That it's not one or the other. It is simultaneously, albeit not in a violent revolutionary way, the best of times and the worst of times. And to try to show the ways in which those bests and worsts intermingle in the lives of real people who are sort of operating the show is what I was trying to do.
Your novel really looks at the present and the near future. And your character, George, is very surprised by how the recent past looks. For instance, at the beginning of the novel, he realizes that the skyscrapers that looked atrocious in 1980 and 1990 now in the year 2000 look quaint, elegant, swingy. And he says he isn't aware of having revised his opinion. His opinion has been changed for him by sensibility osmosis. What do you mean by sensibility osmosis?
Well, although I have gone through the obligatory novelist authorial disavowals of connections between myself and my protagonist, that particular insight was one that I had one day walking up 6th Avenue and looking at these buildings that I used to work in, the Time Life building and its surrounding behemoths from the late 50s and early 60s. And what I mean by sensibility osmosis is that once you see enough glossy magazine articles and newspaper feature stories and movies and so forth that are celebrating this sort of mid-century, late modernism sensibility, even though you haven't gone through a formal process of revising your ideas about plastic chairs and giant ugly buildings and JFK Airport and all these things that you hated a few years ago, you find I found myself, and I think one finds oneself, revising one's opinions in an unconscious way, because suddenly this stuff and this sensibility and this aesthetic is presented as attractive and interesting and sexy, and suddenly I think you find that you've changed your mind without actually having consciously changed your mind.
So what has that happened to you with? It's happened with a kind of skyscraper that you used to find ugly and now looks kind of nice by comparison. What else?
That whole range of stuff. Las Vegas and Frank Sinatra and kind of swingerism, Rat Pack swingerism. That's one whole realm. But I think in smaller ways it happens all the time. And you know, whatever your hesitations or your resistance to certain forms and styles and so forth break down, because it's this sort of background noise saying, this is cool, this is cool, this is no longer uncool, this is cool. And there's this almost a kind of, a subliminal suggestion idea that I think a lot of us give into without even realizing it.
Now, do you read style and fashion pages?
I look at them. And I was for about a decade the architecture and design critic of Time magazine, as well as when I was running Spy. And so it's something I actually care about and I'm interested in a general way. So yeah, I read them. I look at them. I mean, read is maybe not the verb, but I certainly look at that stuff.
Were there any guilty pleasures, so to speak, that you gave into and chalked off as research for the book?
I think there's been a lot of those over the last 20 years of my life as a writer, where you can justify all kinds of guilty pleasures as research. For this in particular, yeah, I mean, one of my subplots involves online pornography, I had to go see what that was all about. And it was more guilty than pleasurable, I must say.
What was it like?
Pathetic and depressing, and fascinating that there is this obviously large and lucrative industry driving this sector, the internet, that is driving our economy, full of what it implies about the literally millions of people, I assume mostly lonely men, sitting at home at their computers is almost too depressing to imagine for me, and which is why it's not a glancing subplot in the book. It's not something I go into in very great depth or length.
The two main characters in your novel are really plugged in people. You know, George is a television producer, and Lizzie is a computer entrepreneur. You're pretty plugged in yourself in the sense that, I mean, you're a writer, you're a journalist, you're always keeping up with things. This new novel is, you know, keeping up with so much in the entertainment and corporate world. Do you ever want to completely unplug for a while and just stop absorbing information, stop thinking about new things?
I do want to, and I do that. I live in an unfashionable neighborhood of Brooklyn that's entirely outside this plugged in glamorous Manhattan fishbowl, and every weekend I go upstate and lie on the grass and watch the clouds. So no, I unplug consistently, but on the other hand, I don't think I'm one of those people who would be happy entirely unplugging. I don't have a cell phone. Another way in which I'm unlike my characters. I'm not that plugged in. I think I figured out where I, you know, in order to maintain some sanity, need to draw the line between, life and media overload. And I try to do that.
Why don't you have a cell phone?
That's a good question. I have in the past. When I had a real job, I had a cell phone, but I haven't, it's been great actually being unplugged to some degree writing this book for the last 2.5 years and not being able to be gotten all the time everywhere. And also, frankly, allowing myself to realize that what in a passing kind of thought of urgency, you can wait 10 minutes or an hour and find a phone somewhere and make the call. So I think actually not having a cell phone, a portable phone, you know, gives me some perspective on in a kind of banal day-to-day, hour-to-hour way, what really is urgent or not, and you know, allows actual thoughts to pop into my head rather than semi-panicky calls from people or thoughts that I have to call this person and so forth. So it gives one a little space and peace in the middle of the day. I think that just because we can do something, as one of the characters says in the book, doesn't mean that we have to or ought to.
Well, Kurt Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Kurt Anderson's new novel is called Turn of the Century. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.